Lecture 18. Shakespeare. Drama, Grammar, Pronunciation.
Shakespeare. The very name evokes the acme of the English language. Shakespeare, perhaps more than any other writer, contributed, it is believed, new words and idioms to English. He created character and concept, and in his plays and poems, he gave rise to what many believe to be the first modern individuals on the stage or in the fictional imagination. Shakespeare's presence in the history of the English language is unquestionably important. And what I would like to do in this and in my following lecture is to look in detail at some features of Shakespeare's language, in particular, how it might have sounded to his contemporaries, what the nature of his lexical resources may have been, that is, what his vocabulary was, what grammatical features exist uniquely in the time of Shakespeare and separate that language from our own. But what I'd also like to talk about are some of the contexts in which Shakespeare's work comes down to us. Such contexts include the stage and habits of performance, rhetoric and the habits of schoolroom education, and printing and the habits of typesetting, bookselling, and book marketing that present the Shakespearean text in a form that visually may seem very alien to us today. Shakespeare was in many ways the canonical writer in English. But how much can we attribute to him? He employed the language of an educated professional, that is, at least up through the grammar school level. He's clearly very well read and conversant in the ideas of the age, both scientific and literary. His contemporary, Ben Jonson, in a famous line, considered Shakespeare to have had, as he put it, small Latin and less Greek. Shakespeare did not have a university-level education, but it seems clear from the basis of his plays and his poems that he knew the great works of history, that he knew his English literary forebears, such as Chaucer and Spenser, that he knew the work of Plutarch and Roman and Greek history, and that he knew the plays of the Roman tragedian Seneca, whether he knew them in Latin or in their Elizabethan translations. Shakespeare was very much aware of his somewhat older contemporary, Edmund Spenser, the author of The Faerie Queen, and he's clearly in tune with many of the social, economic, and political developments of his time. Shakespeare can be read, if you like, as a textbook writer on various subjects of the late 16th and early 17th century. For example, you can read him as a textbook in science. He has a phrase in one of his plays, humorous knight. Now, humorous knight does not mean funny or witty knight, but knight that is wet or dewy, that is, filled with something like the liquid humors that in Renaissance psychology we were made up of humors, blood and bile and sweat. And these humors or these forms of experience and feeling took liquid shape. So humorous knight means it's kind of wet or kind of dewy. Or a phrase such as the elements so mixed in him. The idea here is that the elements are the four great elements. He doesn't mean iron and aluminum and oxygen. He means earth, air, fire, and water. That is, the elements of old alchemy. And so Shakespeare is a textbook of the world. We have the details of London life. We go to the Forest of Arden. we go to the Tempest, to the land of what is called the Far Bermudes, that is, the island of Bermuda, a place only recently visited at the beginning of the 17th century. There is a famous anecdote about a playgoer in the modern period who goes to see a Shakespeare play. And when he's asked about it, he says, well, it was okay, but it was full of quotations. Shakespeare's plays are full of quotations, not simply in the sense that we have quoted Shakespeare so much that many of the lines seem as if they're just quotations or clichés, but Shakespeare is full of the quotations from other earlier authors, from his sources. He's full of quotations because we cannot but hear phrases that are Shakespearean in origin and that now seem memorable. And so one of the questions I want to ask in this and in my subsequent lecture is, what makes a phrase memorable? Why is it that Shakespeare seems to us a tissue of quotations? Before exploring the familiar Shakespeare, however, I want to say something about how he's unfamiliar or alien. Now, you'll recall how, by the 17th century, the great vowel shift had not fully or completely run its course. And we can use the resources of historical linguistics to reconstruct something of the sound of Shakespeare's language. Grammatically, that is, when we look at grammar and morphology, what we see are some uses that to us are only dimly familiar. Now, you'll remember from my earlier lectures that I talked about the rise and usage of forms of the verb do and ing endings, together with changes in the system of modal verbs, adjustments of syntax and word order, and the increase in the idioms of everyday English. And these had a great impact on Shakespeare's language, but also Shakespeare's appropriation of some of these newer idioms had an impact on their later usage. There are, however, many things about Shakespeare's grammar that may strike us as archaic. For example, he employed the use of multiple negatives and comparatives. The most unkindest cut of all is perhaps one of the most famous. He used the third person neuter pronoun it and its in distinctive ways, and I called attention to some of those ways in earlier lectures. And he used older endings for the second person singular forms of verbs, like thou dost, and the third person singular he doth. Shakespeare also, with varying degrees of consistency, used two different pronouns for the second person. And you'll remember once again, thou forms that are singular and informal, and you forms that are plural and formal. And in the second part of this lecture, I'm going to go into great detail by looking at a passage from the play Richard III, which we could see, in effect, as a kind of drama of the second person pronoun. When it comes to vocabulary, or if you like, lexis, Shakespeare deployed the growing resources of the English vocabulary to increase markedly the lexical basis of the literary language. So what do we mean by this? Many of his words come from commerce and trade, many of them coinages, but many of them too represent metaphorical or figurative uses of words or technical meaning. Some display what we might call also a functional shift in their employment as different parts of speech. And I want to pause to give a couple of examples of this. One idea of poetry, if you like, that I think many of us have, and that I think Shakespeare develops to its acme, is the idea that you take a word from one grammatical category and you put it in another grammatical category. In other words, you take a noun and you turn it into a verb. Let me give you an example from a line of Shakespeare. The hearts that spanieled me at heels. That is, the hearts, that is, the deer, that followed me at my heels like a spaniel. If any of you have had a dog, if any of you have had a spaniel, you'll know how that spaniel follows the master at the heels, sort of breathlessly, tongue hanging out. So to spaniel, Shakespeare imagines, as a verb meaning to follow like a spaniel. When Shakespeare does this, he shows us, I think, a new category of poetic language. In other words, Shakespeare bequeaths to later writers not simply a set of words or idioms or phrases. I think he bequeaths to later literary writers an idea of what constitutes the poetic or the literary. In other words, make nouns into verbs, make verbs into nouns, make certain compounds into adjectives. So when we read a poet like, let me think, Dylan Thomas, for example, and we come across a line in Dylan Thomas like, "The heron priested shore," where he's describing a beach or a shoreline full of herons, and they seem to be holding sway over the beach like priests. So it is a heron-priested shore. What you see here is an example of the kind of verbal functional shifting that Shakespeare developed to a high art. Shakespeare gave us an idea of the poetic and the elevated, but he also gave us an idea of the vulgar and the crude. No one curses as greatly as Shakespeare. No one disses like the bard. Here's a little example from the play King Lear, when Kent confronts the self-important steward. And Kent describes him, and I quote, as a knave, a rascal, an eater of broken meats, a base, proud, shallow, beggarly, three-suited, 100-pound, filthy, worsted, stocking knave, a lily-livered, action-taking knave, a whoreson, glass-gazing, super-finical rogue, one-trunk inheriting slave. What is amazing about this passage is not just its string of curses, but that wonderful phrase, lily-livered. We think of lily-livered as the language of the saloon rather than the language of the salon. We think of lily-livered as up there with varmint and buckaroo, a lily-livered cowpoke. But lily-livered is a Shakespearean coinage. And the genius of that coinage sets itself irrevocably into the matrix of the English language. Shakespeare is a master of rhetoric. Rhetoric in his time was the training of the school. Shakespeare and his contemporaries would have been trained in the arts of rhetoric and oratory. Rhetoric is the disciplined and creative use of words for the purposes of persuasion. The job of the rhetorician was to evoke an emotional response in the listener or in the reader. I'd quoted from Thomas Wilson's Art of Rhetoric in an earlier lecture, and this was one of the first major textbooks of the middle of the 16th century that dealt with ways of organizing speech according to formal models, schemes, tropes, metaphors, images that poets and courtiers and orators and writers could use. They were all available in these ways. Rhetoric is the art of organizing language in these special ways, and this was the job of the schoolroom. So when we look at Shakespeare's poetry, especially in the sonnets and in the soliloquies of the plays, we're going to be looking at patterns of rhetorical organization. And so what I'd like to do now is I'd like to turn to an extended passage to illustrate how Shakespeare uses the resources of his language for particular dramatic effect. And the passage that I'm going to focus on is a scene in Richard III. And it is the scene between Richard and the woman that he craves, Lady Anne. Richard is interrupting Lady Anne on her way to Henry VI's funeral. This is the setup. Now, Lady Anne had been married to Henry VI's son, Edward, and Richard had had him murdered. So Richard raises the question of just what caused the deaths, that is, the deaths of Edward, but also the deaths of Henry VI, and Anne shoots back And I'm just going to read it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read it in modern pronunciation, and I'm going to signal the speaker at the beginning of each line or each section. Anne says, "Thou wast the cause and most accursed effect." And Richard says, "Your beauty was the cause of that effect. Your beauty that did haunt me in my sleep, to undertake the death of all the world, so I might live 1 hour in your sweet bosom." And Anne responds, "If I thought that, I tell thee, homicide, these nails should rent that beauty from my cheeks." Richard: "These eyes could not endure that beauty's rack. You should not blemish it if I stood by. As all the world is cheered by the sun, so I by that. It is my day, my life. Anne, black night o'ershade thy day, and death thy life." Richard: "Curse not thyself, fair creature, thou art both." Anne: "I would I were to be revenged on thee." Richard: "It is a quarrel most unnatural, to be revenged on him that loveth thee." This is an immensely powerful passage, and I want to focus on several aspects of its sense and of its sound. But first, let me reread the opening few lines in a historical reconstruction of Shakespearean pronunciation. That is, what these lines might have sounded like to Shakespeare's audience. And I'm going to read the first five lines of the speech I just read. "Thou wast the cause and most accursed effect. Your beauty was the cause of that effect. Your beauty that did haunt me in my sleep, to undertake the death of all the world, so I might live 1 hour in your sweet bosom." Now, the most important thing to notice about the sound here is that the great vowel shift had not sorted itself out as fully. And when I read it aloud, what I tried to stress was that the older Middle English, long high vowels, oo and e, had not completely turned into the modern diphthongs, ow and I. And so, thou and my, I pronounced like thou and moi. So too, the older Middle English long vowel, ah, had not fully moved up to its modern position, eh. And so what you have is a word like undertake, which I pronounced more like undertake. These sound changes would have distinguished Shakespeare's English from Chaucer's, but some words were probably still pronounced as they'd been in Middle English. The words cause and haunt, scholars believe, probably were still pronounced caus and haunt as they had been in Middle English. Now, some words are harder to place, and I want to go through this in a little bit of detail here. The word world may not have been pronounced with its old Middle English vowel world, or it may have been pronounced world. The W changes the way in which you pronounce a following vowel. It rounds the form. So very often, just to pause on W's, you can say things like car, but war. That is, the W rounds your mouth and gets you ready and rounds the vowel. But this is also a historical change, so it's unclear whether in Shakespeare's time these W's were actually rounding the vowels, world or world or something like that. Also, the letter R affected the pronunciation of sounds. Now, depending on where you're from these days, you may say the name Mary, M-A-R-Y. You may say the word Mary, M-A-R-R-Y. And you may say the verb to marry, M-A-R-R-Y, all completely differently, or you may say them the same, Mary, Mary, and Mary, or Mary, Mary, and Mary, or Mary, Mary, and Mary. The spoken English of the 16th and the 17th centuries similarly had what we might call an instability of pronunciation of words that were ER or IR spellings. And this instability is still reflected in some forms of modern spoken English. The word person and the word parson come from the same root. Words vermin and varmint come from the same root. Words university and varsity come from the same root. In England, you're a clerk, but in America, you are a clerk. In America, you go to Berkeley, and in England, you had Bishop Berkeley. These are some features of Shakespearean pronunciation that I'm trying to call attention to and that I'm trying to evoke in, if you like, my representation of the sound. But what I'd also like to talk about is the way in which this particular passage is an essay in the second person forms. The entire passage has at its heart the drama of the interchange of thou and you forms, signaling the shifting personal relationships between Richard and Anne. Richard is trying to woo Anne. She is spurning him. She opens with a contemptuous and condescending thou. Thou wast the cause. She's talking down to him like a servant. Richard responds with a socially correct and formal you, indicating that he is directing a superior, your beauty. Anne and Richard, in the course of the passage I read, exchange thou forms and you forms. She vows him and he use her. But in the final line of the passage, when Richard really wants to make it clear that he wants her, sexually, he calls her thee when he says it is a quarrel most unnatural to be revenged on him that loveth thee. When you love in the second person informal. You love in the thou form. You can see how Shakespeare in this passage is manipulating the resources of the language that are lost to us. One must be acutely sensitive to these shifts in pronouns and in grammar. And this is the point I'm trying to make also about the sort of paradox of Shakespeare, that he seems so modern, but he can be so alien. That the sounds, even though they're certainly not Middle English sounds, are really not modern English sounds, and that his grammar, transparent though it may be to us, still hinges on particular details. And here, as I've suggested in this extended reading, they are the details of the second person. In addition to the contexts of grammar, vocabulary, pronunciation, another important context for understanding Shakespeare is the context of print. Now, Shakespeare in print offers many surprises. The passage that I've been talking about from Richard III can be found in the so-called first folio edition of Shakespeare's plays. This book, which was published in 1623, contains just about all of his play texts. But 17th century printing, especially of drama, was a very different enterprise than modern publication. Many of Shakespeare's plays circulated before that posthumous first folio printing. They circulated in different prints, maybe from actors' copies, maybe pirated editions. And these were smaller books called quartos. And in my next lecture, I'm going to spend some time talking about Hamlet and the way in which Hamlet appears differently in the major folio edition and in the earlier quarto editions. What I would like to do now is go back to the passage from Richard III and talk about how it appears in the first folio. In other words, what is there visually about the look of Shakespeare's early printed text that alienates us from Shakespeare, that locates him historically, and that helps explain some issues and resolve some problems that many of us have in looking at early print? So let me begin with one of the most frequently asked questions that I get as a teacher of English, as a historian of language, as a scholar of the book. People will invariably say to me, how come back in the old days, people wrote their S's like they were F's? It's not true. When you look at this passage in the first folio, and when you look at any early printed book, a book printed probably before the middle of the 18th century, you have various forms of the letters. And one of these is the so-called long S. That is, it's a long letter, And it sometimes looks like an F. But the F has a little crossbar and the S does not. When you look closely at the text, you'll see that the S and the F are different. So, answer number one. People did not write their S's and F's in the same way. Question number two. When you look at this passage in the First Folio, and when you look at many early printed editions, what you find is the word that, T-H-A-T, often abbreviated, as it is here, in the line, "These eyes could not endure that beauty's rack." And the way it looks on the printed page is it looks like a Y, and then a tiny T superscripted over it. And this is not it, or yit, or yet, it's that. And in order to explain why it's that, I need to tell you a little story. In Old English, and in Middle English, and in Early Modern English, the sound represented by our modern spelling TH was represented by an older letter that had descended from the runic alphabet. Runes was the system of writing that the ancient Germanic peoples had used. And runic letters were adapted by Old English scribes to represent sounds in English that did not exist in Latin. One of these sounds was the interdental continuant, remember articulatory phonetics, the interdental continuant th, as in the and that. The thorn was a letter that looked like a big P with a flag on it, or it looked like a P with a taller mast. Now, as this came to be written very, very quickly, the bowl of the P gradually changed, and the top started flattening out, so that by the 15th century, when scribes were writing and when printers began to print, this P with a flag on it started to look more like a Y with a hat. That is, it looked like a Y, but with the top of the Y closed off. And gradually, printers maintained this as a convention, and they would use the Y to indicate in certain abbreviations the sound TH. So very often you will see in early printed books that looks like YT. It's not. It's the descendant of the old thorn, th, with the abbreviation. So th, that. Sometimes you'll see the definite article look like Y-E. It is not. The hallmark of the cute is ye olde shoppy, ye olde tavern. The definite article in English was never ye. It was the or the. The Y is a printing convention that descends from the manuscript tradition of writing a TH sound using the old runic letter thorn. And over time, the shape of that letter changed, and it looked like a Y. And so, if anybody asks you, it was never ye olde shoppy. The look of Shakespeare in his time is as different as the sound of Shakespeare in his time. And so what we need to see in understanding Shakespeare's place in the history of the language is his relationship to speech sound, to grammar, to vocabulary, and to print culture. In my next lecture, I'm going to look at some of the ways in which the stage and the page work in tandem and in tension to give us a Shakespeare that may be remarkably familiar, but also one that is radically alien. And in the so-called bad quarto of Hamlet, we may see things that today we may not simply let be, but which we would rather not be at all.